One woman's love for two men was enough to bring a legend to ruin. Could it be that Greer Galloway is headed for the same fate? With her heart torn in two, she has no other choice except to face whatever trials may befall her and the men she loves. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. I took a chance on today's book, so I hope you will join me for what is, frankly, a hell of a ride. Today we read American Queen by Sierra Simone. It's the first in a series called New Camelot. This was unknown to me before I opened the book, but it didn't matter. I was captivated. This was the second book that I picked up when I had that impromptu bookstore trip that netted us Once Upon a Royal Summer, and I couldn't have picked up two more different books than if I had tried. I took a bet here. I knew what I was going to get when I chose Royal Summer, but I didn't know what to expect with American Queen. From the name of the series, we can surmise that this novel and its sequels are based on the legend of King Arthur and the Knights of Camelot. I'll admit to a bare-bones knowledge of this particular mythological canon, but to be fair, Arthurian legend is fluid at the heart. It's been handled by so many authors, both historical and current, that who King Arthur really was is anyone's guess. Was he a real person? Was he a king of legend? Was he an archetype like Beowulf? There are so many scholarly approaches, and it's possible we may never truly know. Even well-known characters in the canon, like Lancelot, weren't part of the original mythos, added only later by other authors. From what I know of the Arthurian canon, American Queen seems to play right into the usual script, but we'll get there. The big thing that's different is that our story takes place in the current era, but in a slightly alternate dimension. It surrounds the American presidency, with at least the last several presidents being different from what we know. And speaking of different, this novel stands out on the bookshelf. There's a general size and shape that romance novels tend to take. American Queen follows none of those rules. It's big, first of all, taller and wider than most anything on my shelf, and it is a whopping 419 pages, the longest that I've picked up so far. I try to keep my choices under 350 pages, mostly for my own sanity, but something called to me with American Queen. So since we've got a lot of ground to cover, let's get started. Our cover is, well, stunning. Blue is the dominating color, suggesting an elegance fit for the title. Our model faces away from us, a woman in a satin blue dress, with a back that plunges near to her waist. Down her back lays a large ornament dappled with diamonds, and her hair is twisted into a tight golden bun, and jewels drip down from her ears. It's an almost minimalist cover, but it does what it needs to do. It certainly got my attention. Off in the right corner are the words, "I serve at the pleasure of the president." Maybe that's what snared me. We open our book to find the word "the wedding day" waiting for us at the top of the page in bold black letters. Greer Galloway is getting ready to walk down the aisle at her wedding. We don't usually start here. Okay, we've never started here, but I'm not saying no. I get thrown for a loop, albeit not a big one, when I see our novel is in the first person. We've come across this style of writing once before with Haven in episode 21. Unlike Haven, however, our novel stays solidly with Greer's perspective. This is a little unusual, as romance novels like to bounce between our two intendeds to get a full picture. Even Haven followed this rule. Now, as we see Greer take her steps to marry her beloved, who we will learn is the President of the United States, it sounds as though she is under a hint of stress. And there are so many clues laying about that tell me that this won't be a straightforward romance novel. It's the three of us. Ash, stern and powerful, Embry, haunted and pale, and me, with bite marks on the inside of my thighs and a hammering heart. It's when I'm almost to the front that I see the best man has a bite mark of his own peeping above the collar of his tuxedo, large and red and fresh. It's when I'm almost to the front that I see the small white square in Ash's tuxedo pocket isn't a silk handkerchief, it is undeniably the familiar lace of my panties. No one who hasn't seen my panties would know, but he's so blatantly displaying them like a trophy. The last time I saw them, they were clutched in Embry's strong fist. This is an interesting start, and not just because of the wedding. It looks as though we have a love triangle happening, and dare I hope we might get some poly action as well. Ooh, be still my heart. The panty pocket square certainly has some implications, doesn't it? There's a feeling of, shall we say, ownership with this move. Ash is making a statement to Greer that he will do what he likes with both her and Embry. I cannot wait to see how Embry becomes involved and how they'll move forward. Now, I didn't pick up on this originally. Like I said, I wasn't aware of the novel's inspiration when I bought it. But we've got a clear look at the original myth in this opening chapter. Greer, Guinevere, Ash, Arthur, Embry, Lancelot. I'm not sure where we got Embry from Lancelot, but I'm positive there's an Arthurian scholar screaming at me right now with the answer. Email me if you know, I'd love to put that puzzle piece together. There's also some Christian overtones, or at the very least Catholic ones. During her march, Greer wonders if God is giving her a warning, but if God is warning her, she's not going to listen. Bold choice. The Christian influences aren't really a surprise either, since Arthurian lore gets steeped with Christian mythology, what with the whole Holy Grail thing. The story opens proper with the next chapter opening with 18 years ago. Greer was 7, and she says that she was cursed by a wizard. All right. Little Greer has grown up deep in the minefield that is Washington politics. Her grandfather at one time had been the vice president, and Greer enjoyed all the status that his station gave her. He treated her like a princess, letting her dress up in beautiful gowns, taking her to parties and galas, and letting her roam the rich and powerful guests like a mascot. Greer eventually figured out that her grandfather had a purpose to all this, but not necessarily an unkind purpose. It just so happened that Greer was naturally curious and naturally observant, and people might say things that they believe young children would never understand or remember in their presence. And Greer wasn't resentful when she figured it out. More so, she was really just happy to help him and happy to help watch and learn. It was at one such event where Greer was introduced to a man named Merlin Reese. He didn't look like a wizard, but he was certainly unsettling. Even at 7 years old, she felt as though Merlin could see everything about her, right down to her core. I'd be a little freaked out, too. Her grandfather is pulled away for a moment, and Merlin kneels down in front of her. He speaks as if this wasn't a political novel or even a romance novel. He speaks like you would expect a man named Merlin to speak, using vague phrases that don't seem to have any meaning, and speaking as though he could see the future. He tells her to keep her kisses to herself, that she might undo all of the hard work her grandfather had done should she kiss someone else. Her 7-year-old mind saw some logic here. She lived in a world of fairy tales, and in fairy tales, kisses were magic. Then he apologizes to her for her parents, which was unusual since they were away on vacation and perfectly fine, and returns her to her grandfather. Sadly, that premonition becomes truth, as the next morning she hears about the death of her parents. The book isn't exactly straightforward with how it happened, showing us Greer's fitful dreams of people crawling through the mud and a train crashing down a failed bridge. It sounds like a political assassination, but we can't be sure at the moment. Greer comes to the conclusion that if he'd been right about her parents, then surely he'd been right about keeping her kisses to herself. When she's 14, her grandfather asks her if she'd like to go to an English boarding school with her cousin Abilene. Abilene seems to be a bit of a wild child, and I suppose Grandpa Leah is hoping that both the boarding school and Greer's presence might be enough to settle her down. He's wrong, of course. Abilene is wild as ever, but at least Greer goes with her on her exploits to keep her safe, to a point. As they grow up, Greer feels that Abilene is everything she isn't. Beautiful, confident, and assured that she has everything the boys want in a fling. The only thing Greer has going for her is her hair, long, golden, and radiant. And we learn that Abilene has a mean, jealous streak, unhappy if Greer has anything that shows her up. Looks like Abilene is one of those who-needs-enemies-with-friends-like-these sort of friend. Goody. We get a snippet of a conversation between the two girls at school, Abilene trying to figure out why Greer was so celibate compared to her. Greer tries to deflect. Maybe it's not boys that she's into, but Abilene rejects this, knowing more than a few girls who would be happy to kiss Greer, but Greer doesn't say anything, keeping the secret of Merlin's prophecy to herself. Our story jumps back to the present day. Greer has recently completed her master's in medieval literature, and she's teaching a class on Arthurian lit. This moment is probably for folks like me a little slow on the uptake that, yes, we are going there. If I thought the Merlin thing was weird, this brought everything into focus. Greer finished up her lecture telling herself that she's got everything she could want. A degree, a job teaching at Georgetown, love from her grandfather, everything. So why doesn't she feel satisfied? She goes back to her office to grade papers and to work on a book she's been writing when in walks a blast from her past, Embry Moore, who is currently the vice president. Of course, she trips over herself to greet him, but he waves it off. He offers to take her to dinner, even though it's gotten a bit late for such an engagement. She hasn't seen or heard from him in 5 years, so it's a little bit jarring. She tells him that she can't handle the media blowout if they're seen together. She is still the granddaughter of a former vice president after all, but Embry promises that he will be a perfect gentleman and that they will have perfect privacy. They arrive at a small but delightful Italian eatery open just for them, and Greer asks what this is really all about. Embry tells her that the president, Maxon Colchester, wants to see her, but she can't understand why. She's shocked that he even remembers her, since they've only crossed paths once or twice, 10 years ago. And why had Maxon, known to us as Ash, sent Embry instead of telling her himself? Because we get a visit from the dead woman trope. Yes, we're going to get that one today. Ash's wife, Jenny, had died a year ago, and because presidents have to follow different rules, it wouldn't be a great idea to yet be seen with a woman, so discretion had been called for. Another flashback, this time back to the aforementioned 10 years past. Abilene and Greer are getting ready for a party. Grandpa Leo had invited Greer since it was her 16th birthday and grudgingly had allowed her to bring Abilene along. It's become very clear that Abilene is a toxic presence in Greer's life. Best friends one moment, acidic jealousy dripping from her the next. She's got Greer stuck in an abusive loop, and it's difficult for Greer to break away. Tonight, Abilene is in toxic mode and breaks away from Greer as soon as they hit the party, and it's clear that Abilene has done some nasty work on our heroine. Greer is showered with compliments, but she has a hard time accepting any of it. Not only is she worried about Abilene's mood, but she knows that the only reason anyone finds her beautiful right now is because Abilene isn't standing next to her. She walks away to get a breather when she runs into none other than Merlin Reese again. It's brief, but she remembers their first meeting and doesn't say much to him. She runs off again, looking for Abilene. When she does find her cousin, she finds her with some random guy at the party who rushes away at the sight of Greer. This sets off Abilene, who screams at Greer for ruining her life. She smashes her drink glass on the ground and flees the room, leaving Greer alone to literally pick up the pieces. I don't know enough about Arthurian lore to equate Abilene with anyone. Unfortunately, Google isn't helping very much. Her name isn't a one-to-one anywhere, but the book might be giving me a hint. When Greer was in her lecture, she discussed Mordred as a character that should remind us that love, trust, and family don't always equate in the same space. If Abilene has a one-to-one counterpart, the best that I've got is Mordred. There are other events that support my theory, but we will have to wait on that. As Greer is cleaning up the glass shards, she hears a voice. The voice was American, which at this very London party was enough to make me pause and look up. He was in his mid-20s, wearing an army dress uniform, and as he strode towards me, it felt like all of the air left the room, like I couldn't breathe, like I would suffocate, but suffocate in the kind of way where visions danced before your eyes as you die. Broad, powerful shoulders tapered into trim, narrow hips, and his face. It was a hero's face. Chiseled jaw, strong nose, full mouth, emerald eyes, and raven hair. I'm going to tap the timeout bell to remind us all that in this moment, Greer is 16, and this 20-something man had just walked into the room. She reads his name tag, and we figure out that this is Ash. This doesn't bode well. Oh, okay, it kind of does. I mean, it's fine. We wouldn't be here if certain lines had been crossed, because I would have chucked out this book and never told a soul. But we need to understand that the book is dancing very, very close to some important boundaries. He kneels down to help her pick up the glass, telling her that Abilene was jealous. He'd been stuck on the patio when Abilene and her boy toy had entered the room, so he saw their exchange as they'd left. Greer shakes off the compliment, as usual, and he notices that she's cut herself on the glass. As he gathers the glass out of her hand, Greer looks at him, really looks at him, the way she'd learned when she'd gathered information for her grandfather. She makes an observation worthy of Sherlock Holmes, offering that meditation helps with insomnia, a guess that she made based on clues she found in his face. There's a tender moment between them, her suggestion thawing the air, and the tenderness rockets straight to hold on a moment when Ash puts her bleeding finger into his mouth after removing the glass. I could feel every flicker of his tongue, every soft scrape of his teeth, and every thrum of my pulse and every beat of my heart cried out for more, for something, for I didn't know what, but parts of me knew. My skin erupted in goosebumps, and I wanted to press my thighs together to soothe an ache that seemed everywhere and nowhere all at once. When Colchester lifted his head, a small drop of blood clung to his lower lip, and he tasted it with his tongue, his eyes locked on mine. I couldn't breathe, couldn't speak, couldn't think. I could only feel. Feel and then obey when he said, "Stand up." I realize that this is fiction, that it's almost fantasy in its own right, but sticking a stranger's bloody finger into your mouth is such a risky move, and we have to hope to God neither one could give the other anything. Also, 16! Anyway, Ash very sternly tells Greer that she is not allowed to hurt herself over Abilene ever again. If you've seen the movie Secretary, it's a little like when James Spader's character tells Maggie Glennon-Hall that she is not allowed to cut herself anymore. I wouldn't be surprised if this is a direct reference to the film, given how things play out. Here, Ash knows how to dance the dance. He asks Greer for her name and asks if he can touch her again. She says yes, and he gets in close, tracing his lips along hers and down her neck and collarbone. He asks if she likes the feel of his lips on her skin, and she says yes again, and he pushes her for more. What else? She's honest and tells him that she likes it when he tells her what to do. Stand up, stand still, and such. And she knows what the next question will be, wishing to God that she could lie, knowing that she can't, remembering what Merlin had told her all those years ago. Ash asks her if she is 18, and she tells him no. This is where Ash should have walked away, but Greer doesn't want him to leave, and he's fighting with himself. He kisses her, Greer's first kiss, and tells her that she is very dangerous. Merlin arrives, looking for Ash, and the two, however reluctantly, part ways. What follows next is a series of letters, written by Greer and sent to Ash. We get a little exposition here, that there's a war involving the Carpathian region, I'm guessing as an allusion to Carpathian Ruthenia. I'm not a historian, and I certainly don't know a thing about that particular region, so I'll leave it alone. But it is clear that Greer is the only one writing. From what we can gather, she's been writing Ash with no response, but she's not terribly bothered by it. Near the end of these letters, though, she tells him that she won't write again. On her 17th birthday, a little tipsy and restless, she writes Ash one final time. And this letter is very, very different from all of the others. Descriptions of what she is doing with herself, of what she wishes Ash would do to her. It is exactly the kind of thing that a man in his 20s should avoid from a 17-year-old, but for all we know, he's either not getting these letters or he's ignoring them completely. The letter is shockingly descriptive, painting a vivid picture of Greer pleasuring herself as she writes this letter, tipsy and bold as she is. I would feel a lot better about it if, you know, she wasn't a literal teenager. We're brought back to the present, and Greer has agreed to meet the president in the church that she attends. She feels every bit that enraptured teenager all those years ago, as if the decade between now and that kiss didn't exist. Ash thanks her for meeting him, apologizing for having sent Embry instead. He says something that says they didn't know each other. It might feel strange for such a personal request. Except Greer does know Embry, but we'll get there. Greer asks him why he wanted to meet with her, and he's straightforward about it. He hasn't forgot that night in England where they kissed. He hasn't forgotten that brief moment that they met 5 years ago in Chicago. No matter where he was in his life, he hadn't forgotten her. But he'd also kept the hell away from her. That's my interpretation, by the way. He doesn't exactly mention it. And I think that redeems him a little bit. He met a girl that he thought was older than she was, and wisely stayed far away. He thought about returning from his deployment and finding her when it was more appropriate, but then the war had started. He was promoted, and when he came back, he got on the path that would make him president of the United States. Eventually, he got married, and he did love his wife, but Greer had never left him or his heart, as far away as he was from her. Tonight, he's come to ask her to be his. Not for a date, but to be his. She's worried that what's between them is a fluke, but when he asks what he could do to earn her heart and her trust, she tells him that he already has it. Later that evening, with her permission, Ash sends a car to pick her up. Greer spent a lot of time distancing herself from the political world, and she knows that when she gets in that car, that will all be over, and she'll have to face down the Beltway once again. Despite herself, she gets in, and she's whisked away to the residence. Throughout the novel, we'll meet a few characters who are very clearly modeled after the Knights of the Round Table, so that's a little fun touch. We meet one at the White House, a fellow who goes by the name Belvedere. He's nice enough and calming presence for Greer. He tells her that he, along with the rest of the staff, are relieved to see that he is moving on after losing Jenny. He doesn't say it like that, exactly, but Greer is given the assurance that this is not typical for Ash, inviting someone to the residence. When Ash finally arrives, Greer is practically electrified. She mentions that it's still surreal to her that she's here, that he remembers her, and he asks her to take a seat with a smile. Oh, not on the couch. Oh, no. He wants her to sit on the desk, facing the chair. And he's got a small box in his hands. I wonder what it is. She does as she's told, and he thanks her for listening to him, which earns the confession that she likes listening to him. One thing that I love about this novel is that they're open with their communication. Perhaps not as much as they could be later on, but here, Greer encourages Ash, telling him he can't chase her away by being too direct. He's telling her that he asks a lot from the people that love him. His position, his power, things that we might all consider obstacles to living a normal life with normal relationships. As in relationships without the stress of being the freaking president kind of normal, I mean. He tells her that they are going to have a conversation, and she is allowed to walk away at any time. And then he asks if she has ever used a safe word. Apart from the King Arthur hints dropping left and right, we've been getting some foreshadowing about the kind of relationship Ash and Greer were going to have, and here it's finally confirmed. Personally, I enjoy the inclusion of BDSM in these novels, because I enjoy that dance between the dominant and the submissive. When we add Ash's position as president into the mix, it amplifies the power play that we are about to watch. I like to think that Ash knows how careful he has to be. He opened this discussion with the preface that Greer was allowed to leave at any time, and his next point of action is to hand her the security of a safe word. He tells her that if she doesn't have one in mind, she can use his first name, Maxon, as the word that will make everything stop if she needs a break or wants to leave completely. In this one conversation, he tells her that he might not always want pain, but he will want control. It's who he is, but he leaves every door open for her to retreat if that's what she needs to do. He says that he wants control, but he's given Greer the ultimate power over their relationship. As we continue with the novel, we will see Ash check in with Greer when he can see her struggling and remind her of the safe word. And the security of the safe word reassures Greer that he won't cross that uncrossable boundary, which allows her to push herself into new experiences. That's what a safe word is, what it needs to be, and I'm thrilled to see it used this way in a novel that I found on the shelf of a mainstream bookstore. Greer tells him to show her what he wants. She knows how to make him stop, so she's not afraid. He responds that she doesn't know him, doesn't know if she could trust him, and she gives him one of my favorite quips in this book. If she can't trust a war hero and the President of the United States, she can't trust anyone. I mean, the presidential seal is not a good marker for trustworthiness, but I see where she's coming from. He sits in the chair, puts her feet on the armrests, and tells her to move her underwear to the side. It sends that conflicting thrill that I think is pretty common in these type of erotic romances, where the submissive loves it and wonders exactly why. All the while, he is reaffirming that she doesn't need to worry about pleasuring him per se. She only has to worry about following his directions and using the safe word when it's needed. Then he hands her the little box. She opens it and inside finds that he has printed out her emails, the ones that had gone unanswered so many years ago. He tells her that he never answered because of her age, and that gets some points for me. He knew that he shouldn't involve himself with her at that age, so he didn't. But now things are different. They are both adults. She is here with him, telling him that she can be his. He commands her to pleasure herself, much like she had done in her final email to him, and she obeys. There's no other way to describe the scene other than hot. It might not feel like a particularly descriptive word, but I feel that it's appropriate. I appreciate that Ash makes sure that she has at least two orgasms before he moves on to the next step. The next step being some rough handling. Before I can again plunge into a who am I mental soliloquy, he says, "Snap your fingers instead of saying my name if you need to." I blink at him, confused, and then all of a sudden his large hand is fisted in the hair at the back of my neck, literally dragging me off the desk and to my knees. I tumble past his legs, his hand in my hair preventing me from using my hands to balance myself, and I land hard on the carpet, my dress catching between my body and Ash's leg and baring my ass. It's head that Ash is after, and Greer is more than happy to comply. This scene is intense. Greer feels both helpless and drunk with power as Ash controls her movements. And it is so vividly descriptive that I can perfectly picture this moment in my head as I read. The first-person narrative somehow accentuates how evocative it all is, and I can tell the author knows exactly how to handle these moments. After Ash has his orgasm, he orders Greer to remain kneeling on the floor while he fetches a washcloth and a hairbrush. Gently, he washes her face and then brushes her hair, telling her that he dreamed of brushing it ever since he'd laid eyes on her. It is heartbreakingly tender, and I almost can't stand it. Remember how in the last book I talked about sincerity? Well, we have buckets of it here, too. There's just a lot more spanking involved this time. After all is said and done, Ash asks if she would like to spend the night, reminding her that there is a risk of the press seeing her leave in the morning. During this conversation, he gently undresses her and puts her into one of his t-shirts, the entire time checking in with her comfort level. He is obsessed with her consent, and that is very much a good thing. He's a powerful man. It is all too easy for him to bully people into doing what he wants. The novel then transports us to 5 years in the past. Greer reminisces that she had told two lies back when she was 16. When she'd emailed Ash, she had told him that all of the girls at her school were obsessed with him, given his prominence in the media as a war hero. The truth was that Abilene was obsessed with him the most, basically leading the charge. And the second lie was to Abilene herself. Greer had watched Abilene's obsession, but she'd finally begun to treat Greer kindly again. Well, as kind as someone like Abilene could be, and she didn't want to lose her friendship again. So she never told Abilene that she and Ash had made out at that party. Now she was 20, and Greer had taken the summer off from university at Cambridge to stay with her grandfather. They meet up in Chicago before going back to Manhattan, and Grandpa Leo asks Greer if she would like to join him for lunch with some colleagues. She obliges, and things are going well until she hears Merlin's name being called, and right behind him was none other than Ash. Greer almost misses Grandpa Leo introducing her to Merlin and Ash because she's caught up in the embarrassment of all of those emails that she had sent to Ash when she was 16. And when he explains that they've met once before, she can't believe that he still remembers her. During the lunch, Greer begins to make some interesting observations. Every word he said, I stored away, as if his opinions on the viability of a third-party candidate were secret revelations about himself. I watched his every movement from under my eyelashes, the way his hand looked as he twirled the stem of his wine glass between his fingers, the way he held himself perfectly still as he was listening to someone else, perfectly still except for the occasional nod of understanding, a stillness that cannot be learned in a courtroom or a legislator's chamber, but in battle, a stillness that could have been curled over a sniper's rifle. It was so deliberate and immovable. A stillness that accounted for the movements of wind and the fluttering of leaves and careful intakes of breath. A stillness that was patient, predatory. I do pause and wonder here about what this passage is saying about Ash's character. The use of the word predatory says a lot, I think. It could invoke the image of a mountain lion, stalking its prey, waiting in that stillness that Greer describes. Does this make Greer an elk or a deer? Does this make her a sniper's target? I could go on and off onto the deep end completely, saying that this might set up Greer into a victim capacity, that there's danger here. Ash looks like a predator to her, and she is at risk of losing herself. I could also be totally wrong on that point, but I've only got a degree in English literature, so what do I know? Greer does acknowledge that if Ash did decide to go into politics, he would eat his competition alive. She's also working desperately hard not to shout at him, if he really remembers her, remembers that kiss that they shared, how much she still wanted to be his. Unable to bear it any longer, she excuses herself from the table as soon as it's socially acceptable and wanders around the museum that they set up shop in. Ash catches up with her as she's looking at the statue of Jephthah's daughter. They discuss the tragedy of the tale, keeping vows, no matter how horrible, even if you've promised to sacrifice the first thing that comes out of your home and out comes your daughter, and how her dedication to her father and God wouldn't allow her to pressure her father from going back on a promise. Ash surmises that everyone comes to everything with agendas of their own, wanting things like this to have some meaning. Greer asks him what he takes from the statue and its story, and he says that God forgives soldiers for unforgivable sacrifices, that they do what they must to save as many as possible, even if one or two other people are harmed. A very, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one or few moment. The moment brings Greer closer to Ash, physically, and just when it's about to get good, Ash comes back to himself and apologizes. Just then, Grandpa Leo comes back to steal Greer away, saying that they will see each other again later that evening for Merlin's 40th birthday party. Oh boy. Abilene is beside herself when she hears that they're going to a party with Ash present, and again, Greer is conflicted between her feelings for Ash and her friendship with Abilene. It can be so hard when we're younger to get ourselves trapped into toxic friendships. And I wish that I knew then what I know now, so I can certainly sympathize with Greer here, but Abilene is not good for her, and I wish she could see it. They arrive at the party, and soon she runs into Merlin, except he's not here to tell her hello. He tells her that he knows that she's here because of her grandfather, and out of love and respect for him, he's not going to ask Greer to leave the party outright, but he tells her that she should leave. And she's finally had it with his behavior towards her, and asks what his deal is. He says that he bears no ill will toward her, he is just trying to keep either her or Ash from getting hurt. The Merlin role ramps into full force here as he tells her that Ash will be a leader who could change the world, and Greer's presence could complicate things. At the moment, she sees Ash, in the crowd with the party, with someone else, a woman. Merlin informs Greer that Ash was engaged to this stranger, and regrets that she had found out so publicly. Greer is more than happy to leave now, and Merlin assures her that she is a good person, that she should still keep her kisses to herself for a little while longer, and eventually she will have her own happy ending. Yeah, sure. In a rush, she flees the party, unfortunately running into Ash and his fiancée, Jenny, in the process, noting that someone could be deeply, mortally injured, and it wouldn't have been anyone's fault. She finally reaches the elevator to take her away, and that's when she allows herself to cry. During the elevator ride, she gets increasingly agitated texts from Abilene, demanding to know why she left the party, and telling her to come back because Abilene just found out about Jenny. Abilene seems to be one of those garbage people who will have no problem ruining someone else's marriage just to get what she wants. As she leaves the elevator, clearly in distress, she catches the attention of Embry Moore. She knows instantly who he is, based on his proximity to Ash as the designated best friend, and they end up in a battle of wits, Embry trying to cheer her up quoting the Bible in Steinbeck and Greer quipping back. It's almost cute, and it's got a great line, too. He makes a joke concerning breastfeeding via Steinbeck, and she says that she didn't peg him for the kinky type. He responds with, "You aren't pegging me at all, that is our current problem." Absolute perfection. I honestly love to see the pegging reference here, but I think the world would be a better place if guys accepted the fact that their G-spot is up their butt and allowed themselves the luxury, if you catch my drift. But Embry turns on the sweet and the charm, saying that he'd like to take her to the pier for hot dogs, a Ferris wheel ride, and more Steinbeck bashing. She accepts his offer, and as they're riding the aforementioned Ferris wheel, she opens up about what made her leave the party in tears, without explaining Ash's involvement. He admits to having a similar predicament, so they agree to chase away their broken hearts with a one-night stand to rock the ages. In all of the other romance novels, this is a complete outlier. Never have I seen a romance heroine go jumping into the bed of other men in order to chase away her feelings for the intended hero. That scenario might exist, but we can probably guess that there's something else at play here. This is as desperate gets. As soon as they are behind closed doors, they can't keep their hands off each other. Greer can already guess the differences between Ash and Embry, how different they would be. We already know Ash is all about consent and checking in. Embry, while also all about consent, is more like a freight train. Before they really get into it, Greer blurts out that she's a virgin. She doesn't want him to stop, but wanted to tell him all the same. She notes that while Ash would stop and check in to make sure everything's all right, Embry keeps on going. And he makes a thing about it, too. There's a bit of blood, as is expected, and Embry claims it as his, that she is giving it to him and not to whoever had made her cry. When they were finished, Embry apologizes for how rough he was. He should have made it more gentle for her first time, but Greer assures him that she loved it, that it was what she wanted. She recognizes that her emotions are a complete mess and might need to decompress. She's worried that she needs to leave, but Embry tells her that he doesn't want her to go. He's not going to be the kind of guy that's going to throw her out as soon as he gets what he wanted. The next morning, she needs to get back to where she's staying with Leo and Abilene, but before she goes, she leaves a note with her number, explaining that she's just gone to reassure her family that she's okay, and that she wanted to see him again that day, and would be expecting his call. But she never saw him again. He didn't call, look her up, nothing. She wonders if Merlin's warning to keep her kisses to herself wasn't for anyone else, but for her own sake, to protect her from heartbreak. She vowed to keep to his recommendations now. No more kisses and no more men. She would work hard in school, read all the books, and make a life for herself where she would be safe from further pain. That, of course, all changed when Embry Moore walked into her office and asked her to dinner 5 years later. And I thought I'd never have to do this again, make a two-part episode, but here we are. However, unlike the infamous Cold Case Colorado from episodes 3 and 4, there's good reason for this split. This book is huge, and it has a lot going on, so it deserves its time. And especially unlike Cold Case Colorado, I am actually enjoying the read, so I'm not sad about this. So I will catch you next week as we finish American Queen. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kong Yin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.